Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. We are winding the clock back a decade to 2008. Spent about an hour speaking with my pal, Alan McNish, via Skype in Monaco about what I absolutely consider one of the greatest drives I've ever seen, I've ever witnessed in person, performed because of him, because of his mistake at Petit Le Mans in October of 2008. Quick setup, this is Al, off pole, the starting second Audi R10 TDI from Audi Sport. At that point in time, all he had to do was climb in the car, fire it up, drive it out of pit lane, around the Road Atlanta circuit, slow down on the front straight and park, wait for all the pre-race ceremonies to begin, the warm-up laps, take the green flag, go race for 10 hours or 1,000 miles, and see how things fared. Well, dear old Al did pull out of the pits, made it up over the hill, and then firmly chucked the thing into the wall, and essentially broke about half of that glorious twin-turbo V12 turbo diesel R10, and then the drama started. And so, looking back at this just simply incredible comeback drive, comeback performance by the Audi Sport team, Champion Racing team, Dave Mirage's outfit blended with Reinhold Yost and Ralph Utner's program. I have not been to every Petit Le Mans. I think I've seen all of them on TV or in person. Be hard-pressed to think of one that's better. This, to me, I believe this 2008 was the absolute pinnacle so far. Not just because of Al's drive, their drive from two laps down to win and beat the almighty, the fastest prototype of the year, the new Peugeot 908, but also the LMP2 battles with Penske running three cars against the Acuras and that whole insane thing. Then we had the Corvettes running. We have all manner of everything in GT1, GT2 then. Just a crazy insane event, but all capped by this intense, purely intense effort by Al and his teammates Emanuele Pirro and Dindo Capello to undo his big boo-boo to kick off this race. So on the 10th anniversary of this amazing win, I figured, hey, let's get Al on the phone and talk about it. So our boy was more than accommodating. Woke him up, apparently. He'd fallen asleep late afternoon, early evening there in Monaco. And a little bit towards the end, the latter portion of our Skype call, a couple of dropouts, and was wondering why, because we'd had a very solid connection. And then one thing I have edited out here was Alan yelling at his son, hey, get off the Wi-Fi. Apparently Finn was watching all manner of downloading everything imaginable, movies and you name it, so that's why Alan's Wi-Fi went from full signal strength to a little bit lacking here, but we get it back towards the very end. If you know Alan, master storyteller, good man, good fun, and yeah, just spending a Saturday morning here chatting with Al about this amazing performance of his. Real fun. Hate the fact that I'm going to miss Petit Le Mans this year. Have some things at home to tend to you may know about, and if not, wish I could be there, but if nothing else, celebrating this particular achievement by Alan, the Audi Sport team and champion 10 years ago. Almost as good as I can do here for you. With all that said, let's get going with Alan McNish on our little Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires.
10 years, is it?
10 years since you effectively destroyed Christian Kleen's career.
It was just waiting to be destroyed. It just needed someone to do it.
10 years, and I've gone back, mate, and looked at a bunch of things that I wrote poorly after the event, during the event, and after the event, and I've tried to be somewhat intelligent by pulling some of that in for us to discuss. I figure before we jump straight into the event itself, I found something that I loved that our boy Bradsky, Mr. Kettler, gave me not too long after Petit, in referring to you and this dual personality that you have in and out of the car. I just love this quote, and I thought it might be great to kick off the conversation. Brad said, regarding one we, Alan McNish, it's like he becomes a different guy in the car when he has prey in front of him. His voice changes. It's more sharp and urgent. He's all about the hunt. I think of a National Geographic show where the tiger is crouched in tall grass with his eye on a caribou. The tiger knows the caribou is about to go down. You know the caribou is about to go down, but the poor dumb caribou just keeps munching on grass without a clue. That's what Alan does to them. The Peugeot boys are nice guys. I really like them, but their eyes kind of gloss over when they see Alan coming. It can't be fun. First of all, that's an awesome quote from Bradsky. But boy, does that sum up Petit Le Mans 2008 if we start at the finish. But let's not start at the finish, mate. Let's come in even before you had your little fun on the recce, before the race started itself. Peugeot and testing. I was looking back. I think the previous Saturday or Sunday in private testing were something like 2.3 seconds faster than the R10s. It really seemed like they were just going to decimate the field. What do you recall, mate, just coming into the race week? Was there that any sense of foreboding of Peugeot's speed?
Well, first of all, I've just got this image now in the mind of this little cat sort of crouching, trying to jump onto a caribou, a tiny little thing sort of thinking that he's, you know, he's about 6'6", but in reality, he's not, he's 5'5". Yeah, that's a cool quote. It's funny, Petit at that time was an extension of the year in reality, because for us, we turned up the first race in the LMS season in Barcelona. And when we saw the performance in practice qualifying race of the Peugeot, then it was a bit worrying, to be honest. And we knew that we had some tools in our toolbox, being that whatever lap time we could do in qualifying, we could do it all race. But the problem was that whatever lap time we could do, they tended to be quite a lot quicker. You know, Le Mans was a bit of a battle all the way through. And then the championship from the LMS championship came down to the last race in Silverstone, where they were leading it and should have won it. And they basically lost it with silly incidents. And the championship went to Rocky and Alex Premat in the sister car. And so, you know, we picked up quite a few trophies, and that was the last one. Petit was the last one. I don't remember a heck of a lot about the testing that you mentioned, to be honest with you. We did a tyre test prior to Petit because of two things. One, it is a very good circuit, or it was for us then, a very good circuit to test tyres, because it has got a little bit of everything, especially the chicane at the end of 10A and 10B, which was, interestingly, where we struggled mostly with the car, was getting the front to change direction through the left and the right, and then get the car straightened to be able to get the power down up over the top of the hill without, you know, having too much understeer on that change of direction, and then the rear sort of squatting and sort of struggling really there. And so with the tyre test, I remember we made some improvements and we got something that kind of worked for us. But at the same time, that was as much a vision towards what we're going to look at in 2009 as opposed to necessarily Petit. I do remember us going into qualifying and having something with the gear shift, and we had a small mod on the shifting to improve the shifting, but unfortunately we weren't able to utilise it. And I think I'll have to look back actually whether this was 2009. I could be actually in the wrong year completely with this point, but
I do know, sure, that, looking back at the notes, at least that I wrote at the time, I believe we spoke after qualifying, and you'd mentioned the mindset, or at least the setup on the car. You guys had not gone for a, quote, quali setup. You'd essentially gone out with the race setup, and you posted, you set pole almost right away, and then sat and waited, and the Peugeot team kept running and running and hammering away, and finally, towards the end of the session, they bettered your lap by a tenth or something, you know, by something very small.
Well, yes, it was very, very, it was under a tenth, and it was then 2008, because the thing that sort of frustrated me a little bit is that I'd got a very, very good lap, and I knew we couldn't really do much more because the tyre would drop off. And you'd start to get a little bit of push, turn three at the top of the hill. It just wouldn't get into the right-hander. and then also 5, and then 6 and 7 at the back end of the track, he would just lose a little bit of the edge of the front grip. And the same at 10A and 10B. And so I was sure I wasn't going to be in a position to go any quicker than what we did. But at the same time, we had, an adjustment to the gear shift that we couldn't use. And that was by the number of gear shifts through the course of a qualifying lap. That was the difference between being on pole and not. And so as much as I probably told you that we were looking for the race, we were looking for the race in a way, but I was actually quite disappointed we didn't get pole, because it was the psychological side of things. If you've got pole, they know they're quicker. If you've got pole ahead of them, then, you know, obviously it puts a little bit of pressure on them and starts them wondering. But at the same time, we had the potential to have it. It's just that we didn't have the software in the car to allow it to happen, which is sometimes the way things are. You know, you think, you know, when you're from the outside, you would put everything on the car, but sometimes, just for various very good reasons, it's not possible to do it.
So I was also looking through some other fun things that I wrote, and this is back when I used to drag my fairly expensive radar gun to tracks, and looking back and found some fun numbers, and I can't honestly say whether this was qualifying or practice, but turn one, for example, Marco Andretti was fastest in his Andretti Green Acura P2 car. At the apex, I was aiming at 143.4 miles an hour. Timo in one of the Penske Porsches was close behind. Among the bigger, heavier diesel P1 cars, had the Peugeot at 138.5, and you were 133.7. Mm-hmm. I realized that, you know, we're talking the P1 cars were 10 miles an hour faster through turn one, but that big old stonking
P2,
twin turbo V12 over your shoulders, though, that's still a brutal amount of speed through turn one.
Yeah, the P2 cars were so much lighter because the regulations were over 900, and they were, I can't remember, they're like 130, 150 kilos lighter at that point. And it was the same in Sebring. I remember they were talking about whether they were going to take the first corner in Sebring flat, and we were thinking, Christ, for us, it's a huge break and try and downshift. You know, flat, are you guys mental? And Petit was the same thing. We could do the last corner flat, but it's just there was no way in the world you'd do the first one. You had to either float the car in on the brake because of the, like you said, though, you've got the weight of the car, the momentum of it, but you also had the weight of then a V12. Twin turbo diesel, particle filters, everything sitting over the rear axle. So that sort of momentum of the rear as you rolled the car into the corner, it wasn't a straight break and turn, it was actually a rolling and floating it in, would sort of take hold, if you like, and it was quite a tricky corner. I'm disappointed, though, very, very disappointed that I was 5 kilometres or 5 miles an hour slower than the Peugeot through there.
Well,
I think that must have been, that's got to have been Dindo driving then, is it not?
Definitely. Oh, yeah.
Or we'll put it down to Dindo. He's not in the call. We'll blame Dindo.
Or Emanuele, you know. I mean, good Lord. Time was coming to an end there. Well, I mentioned, I was just going to say.
Just one thing there, though. There was a difference to remember as well, that we had the open cockpit car and they had the closed car at that moment. And that was the clear crossover point, was 2008, where the aerodynamic downforce and efficiency you could get off a closed cockpit car was so much better than an open cockpit car because of the way the regulations had gone, that it was, you know, I think really a point for us that that's where we had to go with the R18. Now, admittedly, the R15 was already in view and in production by then, but and you can't just sort of bond the top on it, but really for me that was towards the end of the year, it was quite clear where it was going.
So I thought looking back at some of the speeds before we get into the race itself might be fun or poignant, because for those who were not fortunate to watch this race, I consider this 2008 race, it must be the greatest Petit Le Mans, at least for me, but also just the times that have changed and the speed differences. I also went back and did radar speeds leading on to the back straight, and this is just where the fearsomeness of what you were driving and the speed differentials, I hope, come to light here. So coming off of the final corner There was, I guess, between the Peugeot, the Zytec, the Team LNT, Team Lint, 48.7 mile an hour was about the peak. You guys were there right around the same, 48.6 mile per hour. Then you get to the end of the back straight, and that's where all the insanity was captured. The Peugeot, 202 miles per hour before stomping on the brakes, at least when I was recording. That's a gain, mate, of 151.8 miles per hour between corners. And your Audi was thereabouts, 192 to 193 miles an hour. Just hellacious speed. Purely hellacious speed. And I think that might be an interesting point to then jump into getting into the start, what was meant to be the start of the race, those recce laps beforehand, and things starting to go sideways. Tell us about this, mate. One of your more famous performances, but for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, it's got a beautiful place in my heart and the most horrible pain in my stomach as well, that race. Basically, one thing, there was two things that came out of it. One is that the ACO decided to change their philosophy on the regulations for, in my opinion, a very good cause. And the second thing, and it was because of the other point being, second point is that in America, unlike Europe, you weren't allowed to heat the tires. And so therefore, in Europe, we would have tires going on the car to the grid that were preheated. And so therefore, you would have a huge amount of grip. Everything we had done in our tire development was for that heated process, because that's what we were racing. And it was quite cold in the morning, because you remember you've got what could be a 10-hour race, but also it starts early.
Early start, definitely.
So I toodled out of the pits, released the limiter at the end of the pit links. I was going to take the car to the grid. And I got up over the top of the hill, the tires juddered, it goes drrr, as I turned right. And then as I was going left through the next, I was in second gear, I think, and I was probably about maybe 20, 30% throttle and shifted up the next gear to third. And the next thing I know, I was actually at the bottom of the hill at four, and half of the car was missing.
Oh,
and I promise you, it was like that. It was like, what on earth happened there? And there was a moment where I'm looking around and thinking, what's happened? I just couldn't compute what had gone on from where I was to where I'd ended up. So I've radioed, the clutch rest is off the car, half the car's gone on the left-hand side. And I radioed in, and then sort of got the car moving and drove it back into the pits, and it was straight into the, we'd already prepared it, so it was straight into the tent, and got out, went into the front of the truck, and they just jumped on the car, split it off, gearbox was off the back, the left suspension was gone, it was quicker to change all the rear end than it was to change the left-hand side, and then as well the front, the bodywork, the nose, the radiators, the floor, everything was wrecked, and I was just absolutely so angry and also so confused, because I still wasn't really 100% sure what had happened. It was only after the race the next day where we got the data out and looked, and it was like 28%, 30% throttle, and just with a huge amount of torque that those things had, we had well over 1,000 newton meters of torque, like well over 1,000 newton meters of torque. And so when the acceleration came back in with the gear shift, then it just shot left, because it was a slight left-hand turn. We had quite a lot diff in there as well. And so it just basically, with a different temperature of the tire left and right, being cold coming out of the pits, it lit up a little bit the inside and turned the car left and hit the wall. And
it's also worth mentioning, Alan, just for those who were unaware, it's not as if you had wound the thing up to 12,000 RPMs. The rev band was so small to begin with, and such prodigious torque was built, even at 28% throttle, you're having to flirt in a very narrow window to not have this thing become just a raging beast. So, I mean, it's very much like an on-off switch on cold tires.
on our Switch in warm tires, as opposed to cold. It was in hot tires. It was like that. You know, you're talking about the most power I've ever had in a racing car in my entire career. It was the biggest, most aggressive thing I've had, which was one of the reasons I loved the car. It's one of the reasons that when you ask me what's my favourite car, that revision of it, the 2008 R10, is my favourite ever car to drive in my career, because you had to pick it up, you had to manhandle it, and if you didn't, it would bite you. You know, it was a car that was sort of one of those ones, you talk about a caged tiger, you had to be the cage and that was a tiger. And that's what I loved about that car, but it bit me on that occasion. And like you say, it was grid-like grandma, is our expression from Howden Ains, who was our engineer H. And it was literally going to the grid like grandma. And the thing was, I was maybe 50 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour, 50, 60, somewhere about there. Not much at all at a point in the circuit where you'd be doing 120, 130. But it didn't matter. It was just and into the wall, and it's a concrete wall. So, you know, the speed and the momentum and the weight of the thing as well was the thing that sort of did a hell of a lot of damage. So I just going on a wee bit here, Marshall, because I'm in the front of the truck. They're on the car and get everything done possible, and I'm kicking the hell out of the front of the truck, which I was in the car. It's beginning of Petit Le Mans. We'd done everything so well in our testing, and you know, we were ready to go rock and roll, and there's plenty of adrenaline surging through my veins at the time. And Dindo and Emanuele walk in. Oh. And they walk in, coming in through the back of the truck, not through the awning. And they go, "Hey, how is it? Car okay?" I went, "Car okay? Car okay? Have you seen that car? Look at that car out there. It's not okay." And I just lit up, buddy. You could see them go, "Oh, no." It's like, "No, it's not okay. Guys, it's not okay."
Well,
and at which point, Emanuele told me afterwards, he said, there and then, he kind of hoped, in a way, they didn't get the car out, because we would be so far behind that we would not actually have a chance, and it would be an afternoon of chasing dreams as opposed to chasing reality. But he didn't, and I honestly didn't believe when I saw the gearbox off the back that we would, because it's 40 minutes before the start of the race, we would be in a position to get the car out. And so I was in the sort of bubble of the Christ Almighty, get it repaired, because I want to have a chance to, you know, get out there and sort of repair a bit of damage, if you like. But from their point of view, it's a case of, crikey, if it's going to be an hour and a half, with the competitive level of the field and where we would be, we would be, you know, chasing 10th or something at best. But we underestimated the Audi and the Yost guys being able to, you know, repair the unrepairable.
So I found two more quotes here, which I think just serves up the special nature of not only what they achieved under that tent, under heavy strife, but also just the spirit within the team, which definitely deserves acknowledgement. So this also came from Brad right after the race. He said, "I've known Alan for over a decade. We've worked together for many years, and I appreciate the trust and honesty he gives me." He says, "He pulled in, hopped out of the car, walked right up to me, put both hands on my shoulders, squared my shoulders to him so he was looking right in my eyes, and he said, 'Brad, I completely effed up. I'm so sorry. This is my fault. No excuses. I royally effed up.'" And he mentioned that not because he felt an admission of guilt was necessary, but just instead of just returning this tattered car and walking off like a prat, which some drivers might do, it was just Brad expressing that, hey, we're eye to eye here. We're in this together, good or bad. And then I love this too. He said, "I told Alan to take a deep breath, go find a quiet corner and compose himself, and we get the car ready." He said, "I told him it looked like about a 25-minute job, and I'd grab him when we were within 5 minutes of being ready. That's when he told me he'd drive the car with everything he had, and I didn't doubt him. That's all he ever does."
Yeah, when you see it, and you saw the car under the awning there, and or you maybe ask Dario sometime as well, because Dario afterwards, he said that when he saw the car limping down the pit lane, because he was in driving the Acura to the grid, and he was in the pit lane at the time, and he saw this car coming down in the pit lane in his mirror, and sort of hobbling along, sort of dragging its wheel behind it and things like that. He just said he couldn't stop laughing. He just for laugh. Is that what the hell's he on now?
That's what friends are for, I guess.
But yeah, you can. I wasn't laughing. I wasn't crying. I was absolutely livid, and it was just, it was embarrassing. It was the embarrassment of it. You know, you're meant to be one of the best in the world. You're meant to have control of this car, and you can't even get it to the blooming grid, driving as slow as you could ever drive it. But yeah, the whole crew were super. They were super. I've got to be honest with you.
So let me ask this, Alan. So they're getting the car back together. You're getting close to climbing back in. If and what conversations are taking place between either you and your teammates, you and Ralph Utner or whomever, about let me be in the car as much as possible, I want to make good on this, or not? I don't know. I honestly don't know there was anything like that, or if you just slotted into the pre-arranged plan.
No, we had our pre-arranged plan. There was nothing like that at all. And that was the same all the way through. You know, it wasn't the first time we've had a bit of a ding going on or an incident, and the way we've had to try to recover the best we can. And, you know, at the end, there was no sort of thing. I was meant to be doing the start anyway. And so, therefore, when the car was repaired, then I would get in the car first and we'd go through the order, and that would be the way it would go, and we'd see where we ended up at the end of the race. There was no thought process there whatsoever. And so, you know, it was, the other thing that was quite interesting on this, because as soon as the guys got the sister car onto the grid, then they came straight round, and so both car crews were jumped on it inside the thing. And you'd think they've got a fair old day's work ahead of them. So having, you know, for the car that hadn't got the problem to then jump in, and that was one of the sort of team spirit side of things, that it was a perfect example of it. They were willing straight away, A, to jump into it, and also from a team perspective, that they were quick thinking enough to say, right, okay guys, what's best for us overall here, to have two in the fight if we can, as opposed to one and we sort of leave one to do its own thing. And you know, it was, you mentioned Ralph there and mentioned Bransky, but you know, Dave Mirage was standing very much in the garage watching it all going on, and the way that everybody was on the car was, I tell you what, they allowed me to save a little bit of embarrassment out of the day.
So the story would be less interesting, Alan, if the car was repaired, you rolled to grid in time, did the formation laps, and off you went under green. The race actually got going while the car was stationary. Tell us about, I guess, effectively having to sit and wait and watch as you went two laps down at the start of the race before you could start playing. What was that like, and what was the mindset once you were able to hit the gas and roll out of, or hit the diesel, I should say, and roll off of pit lane?
I don't know. It was a sinking feeling. You're hoping that for some reason they're going to delay the start. You're hoping that your afternoon or morning, as it still was then, isn't going to get any worse. But when I heard them firing up, and I didn't even have my helmet on, you know, as I'm still bumping around in the front of the truck, then that was a sinking feeling. I suppose it was, thankfully it never happened to me, but it was like being stood up at the altar in the way. And just the horrible sensations. But then Brad came in actually quite quickly afterwards, said, right, get your helmet on, get ready, just in case. And I stood there for what seemed like an eternity while they're putting the last things of the car together, and I jumped in when it's still on the stands. I remember that part. And I remember Dominic Zeitler, who was part of the Audi sports side of things, leaning in, and he said, right, I've bonded the clutch rest on the side of the monocoque. You can't put any pressure on it for the next 2 hours because I need it to bond and secure for the rest of the race. Because the whole clutch rest had come off because my foot's been on the clutch when I've hit the wall, and the force meant my foot went forward and ripped the whole clutch rest. And my feet, I remember my left foot, I had to bring it round from behind the clutch, but I was a bit confused why, because my foot wasn't even on the clutch.
Wow.
And so Dominic had bonded on, and that was the last thing. So I had to sort of keep my leg back and off the clutch. So I had no support whatsoever on that left side for the first bit of the race. But the car dropped down. I went to the end of pit lane and then went out again on cold tyres. So I can tell you, I was very, very nervous through turns 3 and 4. But the race was going on. Thankfully for us, it went to a full course yellow very quickly. And so therefore, I was able to get up to speed. And then afterwards, we just went as fast as we could, in all honesty, through the middle of the start in the middle of the race, just trying to pick up the full course yellows and trying to be in a position where we would pit at the time to get our laps back and at least get onto the lead lap, which I think we did after, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours or something like that. We were back onto the lead lap and then see where we were. And that was one of the beautiful things about racing in America. You could be down right at the beginning, but you also could come back because you weren't out. And the way the regulations were, it always allowed you an opportunity, if you were quick and aggressive with your strategy, then to get yourself back into the game, which thankfully we were able to do. The engineer was Ron Mathis, late Ron Mathis.
Dear Ron.
And Ron sort of was, he thankfully very experienced with it as well. And Mike Peters, between Mike and Ron, they got us back onto the lead lap quite quickly with Emanuele and Dindo as well. There's a lot of people talk about the performance of what I had, but I tell you, without EP and Dindo doing exactly the same sort of performance, we would never have been in the game either. So, you know, it was a testament to everybody there that we got back into the position.
So as I remember the early hours of the race playing out, and then even when we get to the middle section, admittedly, I should have, but I've never really caught up with Bruno Famin or any of the drivers from Peugeot to ask their mindset. Because part of me wonders if they were aware or how much attention they were paying to this fight back that was going on with you, Dindo, and Emanuele in the car, because that's the thing that I and I think many others started tracking just externally. Hey, all right, they got a lap back, and hey, there's enough time to get another, and hey, this could become a race. Once we start getting towards the end of the show, I don't know if Peugeot changed their strategy at all. I don't know. I don't seem to recall them trying to set the world on fire with lap time and pace. Again, I know I'm asking you to maybe recall some things with a team that you weren't a part of, but do you have any recollection of whether you thought the Peugeot team was maybe doing anything correctly or incorrectly to manage against what you guys were attempting to do?
I don't think so, Marshall, because I think they had their attention set between two Penske's, the Acuras, and also our sister car anyway. Mm. So I think we were sort of just coming up in the background, and it was only, I think, when we got to maybe 3 hours from the end of the race, 2.5 hours from the end of the race, and there was quite a big accident. And then it was first to seventh or eighth, and it was all in one train. And I think that's probably where there was certainly a little bit more of attention. Up until then, we were either a lap down, 2 laps down, or half a lap away or something. So actually, their attentions, I would assume, would be a little bit more focused on who was sitting second and third and right around about them, as opposed to some bunch of dumbos that had shunted the car on the way to the grid and were, you know, half a lap back. But I never asked them about it. I'm sure they were a bit disappointed afterwards.
Oh, yeah. One of their favorite topics to discuss, I'm sure. Let's sit down and talk about this.
But, you know, it was with them, like I said, the couple of advantages that we had. One was that we were able to qualify and race at the same pace. So whatever we could drag out in qualifying, we could pretty much drag it out in the race. Whereas for them, there was a bigger shift between qualifying and race. And so they would come back to our level of performance. And the other thing was, with the way the car was, it became better later on in the race. The more rubber that went down, the more the front would hook up. Like I said to you about the in 10A and 10B in the S's, how it would hook up there, how it would hook up at turn 7 onto the back straight, and then it would allow us to get onto the power a bit quicker, so we'd use the torque better, we'd have less traction control requirements, we'd be able to just carry little bit more speed into the corner as well, because I had a bit more front grip in the apexes of turn 6, turn 3. And all in all, the car just became more alive. That's the best way for me to describe it. It became more alive. And then you, as a driver, you could do more with it. And you could do more with it in traffic as well. And so in traffic, you could start to look at taking someone where you couldn't have done earlier on, because you just didn't either have the grip or alternatively the car balance to do it.
So looking back at some more notes about the race, one common theme that I wrote about, and this is assuming that it was even accurate back then, but there was definitely a bit of a straight line advantage held by the Peugeots. I know that it was fairly common to see on the long straight, again coming out of the onto the back straight, the 908 would often pull about 100 meters on the R10s, and that. Yeah. That bit of seesaw was quite interesting. They're rockets in a straight line, but I don't know if those cars were as fully developed in the corners and such. One thing that I loved watching and tracking and made some notes about was there was a point when we started to get into darkness, Alan, where when you were in the car in particular, there were times where you were taking 2 seconds per lap off of them. Obviously, everything you just mentioned about the additive rubber to the track and, you know, the car coming alive, that helped. But there was also an element of maximum attack, scything through traffic. There just seemed to be a different approach going on in your car, where you were not just using the nighttime to your benefit, but you were just carving them up whenever there was a decisive move to be made that might gain you some extra, claw back some extra distance on track. What was that experience like? Were you locked into this, you know, crazy hyper mindset like that, or was it coming naturally?
I don't know, actually, the answer. What I do know is that we were in a position that year because of the amount of initial squirt acceleration we had because of the torque. And also when the grip was there to, like I said, to overtake in places you normally wouldn't and couldn't. So your time lost through traffic was much less. And there was even a few times when with the speed we had with a, say it was a GTM, coming down the hill through four. So, you know, you've got the long left and then the flat out right. And then there's a little kink, which effectively normally you take straight and then you go up into five. Well, we've overtaken round the right-hand side in the kink, so you're on the wrong side five, and also the left-hand side up into five. And you could do that year because you had the ability to go for it, and also, to be honest, we had the requirement to do it as well. But, you know, so therefore I would say that most of it came down to the fact that we were in a position where the car allowed us to overtake to reduce our losses in traffic. See, you know, you win races by reducing your losses in traffic as much as being fast on your own, because in sports cars, you're never really on your own very much. And there, I think we had one thing. The other thing is that we probably, and you mentioned the straight line speed earlier on, that was where the aero efficiency that we discussed right at the beginning of the show, that's when there was a big switch over and they had that aerodynamic efficiency with the straight line speed, fuel usage, everything else advantage over us. Whereas the one thing that we did have was because we were open top, we probably had a little bit better vision than they had. And so therefore, maybe in traffic, we were in a position to take advantage of it where maybe they couldn't quite as easily, or certainly with less confidence than what we were. And so I think there's probably some of those factors at play as well.
What do you recall, Alan, as we start to get into the last hour or two of the race, how often or frequently are you getting updates from pit lane that you are plus X to the leader and that number keeps coming down? Just curious how clued in you were to the gap you were trying to draw down versus just blinders on, go like hell, we'll see where we end up.
You kind of knew when you were on, you know, right, we're on lap X behind, so it's two laps down. Now we've got our lap back, we're one lap back. Then you'd go again, and then the next target would be the next lap back. And so you were getting some information. There was quite a lot of yellows there as well. And it was, for me personally, because it happened when I was in the car, there was a shunt. And somebody had gone off somewhere, and then we were all lined up, and there was a whole load of GT cars. And then at the restart, there was a crash before they got to the line, coming down the hill into the final corner. So coming over underneath the bridge, there was a big shunt there, and the cars going everywhere. And I've driven into this ball of lights spinning off in front of me, just going flat out, but not really sure where I was going, because I didn't know where the dust was or anything else, and I've sort of came out the other side of it. And that caused another full course yellow. Then we had to run through the pits. And so when we were running through the pits, we took a set of tyres, if I remember correctly, and went onto a different compound of tyre, which was a really sharp call by Ron. And that we didn't lose much time to the leaders because we were already behind them anyway. But I could actually see them. I could see the... so apologies. We had switched before in the previous stop. So at the restart, I was on that tyre already. And then we're coming through the pit lane and I could actually see everybody. Then we're line astern. That's when we had Persh. And then I think Marco Werner was in the sister car. Two Penske's and Acuras and bits and pieces. And that was where all of the cars were together. And I was on a slightly different tyre strategy to the rest because we had taken the option to change when we had our least loss under the previous one. And then I knew it was game on. Then I could see the leaders. You physically could see them. I knew where we were in the chain. I knew that if I overtook one car, I was up one position. I was not in eighth, or I was go to seventh and then up through like that. And that was a heck of a lot of motivation because you could actually, you know, what you're saying about the antelope at the beginning, you could actually see your prey being just a little bit up ahead of you. And so I was able to get past the LMP2 cars reasonably quickly at the race. And because we're quite aggressive there. And whereas we had a deficit to straight line speed relative to the Persia, we had an advantage over the P2 cars. However, we had a massive disadvantage against the P2 cars in down through the thing from that. So we made a break, then we couldn't really get them back. But if we didn't make a break, if I got them straight away, then I could control them. So I had to do it at restarts when we had that possibility to try to overtake on an acceleration or something. And then once I was up into third, I remember with Marco, because Marco, even though he's in the sister car, made me go the long way around, which at the time I thought was not very, very polite of him. But in reality, I know I would have done the same to him. And so coming out, I got him down into 10A, 10B, and had to run around the outside of him into 10A. To be on the inside for 10B. But the car at this point, for me, was perfect. It's one of the most beautifully balanced cars I've ever had round Atlanta. In terms of I could take it inside, I could go outside, I could brake deep into wherever on the inside of the track overtaking and have total confidence that I would get to the corner without locked up wheels and without the car understeering off or pushing or whatever it may be. And so I definitely at this moment, with the last sort of 45 minutes of the race to run, had a car underneath me that I loved driving. And I had a couple of cars ahead, or then by this point, one car ahead of me, which was our nemesis, that was there in waiting. And there was one position, obviously, between us and having a decent result out of what could have been a dreadful day. But I've got to be honest with you, that last couple of stints when we got into that time of night when the car was working, when we had changed tyre and gone onto the softer tyre, then it was absolutely stunning to drive. And when you say about being in the groove, the car was in the groove as much as the driver. I was a bit of a react to it. Beautiful.
Well, I guess the thing that the thing that I loved watching, and also going back and reviewing the footage of it that Speed captured, they were clearly clued into what was going on. They had helicopters overhead tracking your movement. Mm-hmm. They, I mean, this had become the Alan McNish, Audi, fight back versus Peugeot, and again, poor Christian Kleen. It started to have a feeling of inevitability that this almighty Peugeot on pole so fast, the brute of the LMP1 turbo diesels, this thing just looked like it was going to fall. Was there any question in your mind, Alan, as we're getting into the final hour of the race? You see this thing in front of you. You can almost reach out and grab it. Was there any question that that car was going to go down?
I never thought about it, honestly. Yeah. I never, ever thought about it. It was an ex-car, and so from that point of view, it was just what had to be done. I got a few opportunities, because Christian Kleen was in the car. I got a few opportunities to look at him in traffic, and then one of them had a beautiful run onto the back straight, and I thought, right now. And unfortunately, by the time we got to the end of the back straight, then I wasn't in a position to do anything, because he had disappeared off into the distance. And then it was building it back up again. There was a point into turn one where I looked at it into one, because I was quite good into one, actually. But that would have been a really risky move to do it into there. It's very, very quick. And it's a bit like turning into turn 17 in Sebring. You know, if you don't get it right, it's a mighty shunt. If you do get it right, you come off a hero. But I feel too comfortable in doing it there. And I did, in all honesty, have a look down through turn 4 into 5. When he was going to get held up by a bit of traffic, actually dive bombing him into 5. But again, that would have been a case of there was a decent chance of the opportunity came where he basically had a bit of traffic in 5 a lap later. And with the traffic in 5, I did a bit of straight line speed advantage down into 6. I was still able to be close enough. And in all honesty, it was as much of a case before I mentally had realised what I'd done, but he braked earlier than I expected into 6, and so I just went for the gap that was plainly there, and that sort of shook him a little bit and put him offline, and Marco Werner, who was right behind us, because as much as I was attacking him, Marco was still trying to have any team orders. It was a case of, right, don't do anything silly. Alan was on a different tyre strategy, but, you know, we're all racing. And so Marco had a look at him, and unfortunately didn't quite get it done because of the straight line speed advantage. And then it was just a straight dogfight between him and I to the end of the race. And there was two key points. One, where I got traffic out of turn seven onto the back straight, and he had a run at me, and I just hugged the left hand side of the circuit, absolutely hugged it to the white line, because I thought, if you're going to come past me, you're coming past on the hard side, and I'll tell you, I'm going to brake as late as I can, and you're going to have to work for it. And he still tried to overtake on the inside. He had like about a meter, and the car's, you know, 3 meters wide, 3 yards wide, and he still tried to overtake on the inside and sort of kicked up a bit of dust. And I was shocked that he did that, because if he had gone to the other side, I would have said he had an 80% chance to overtake me. But he did. He stayed to the wrong side, and he kicked up a bit of dust. I still held the line, and then that was it. You know, that particular attack is gone, because I then was able to get a bit of traffic after that and to pull away. Then we had a full course yellow. And this was probably 30 minutes from the end of the race, 25 minutes from the end of the race. And there was a GT car between him and I. And on the restart with the straight line speed, because I'd been able to pull maybe 1 second or 2 seconds on him. But the straight line speed, I was very, very vulnerable on that restart. And so I backed him up, and I backed the GT car up, and I gave it the gap to the safety car as it came out of 10B. And up over the hill, I was still coming down into 10A. And then as soon as I sort of judged the safety car would be going into the pit lane, then I just went with the knowledge that he couldn't do anything until he crossed the start-finish line. And so it probably wasn't the most sporting thing to do in Love and War, but this was more war than love. And by the time I got to the line, I think I had a 2.5 second gap, so I had a bigger gap than I had before. And so I used that to my advantage. And then from there, it was a case of running everything I could to the end. And you mentioned about gaps. I had Ron every lap in the middle of the back straight telling me the gap. Never anywhere else, only in the middle of the back straight. It was clear right now, gap, gap, every single lap. Mm. Because it was dark and you can't see the lights. You know, I couldn't tell if it was Marco. I couldn't tell if it was Christian. So a Peugeot or an Audi. And, you know, you look at them in very different eyes in that position. And that was, those last laps were as aggressive in traffic than any others, because if he had cottoned onto the back, if he'd been able to lock onto the back of the car, then once down the straight, he'd have just blasted past, and then it would have all been in vain. But thankfully for us, then he was never able to get close enough to actually get the job done.
So I happen to be standing on driver's left, right next to the start-finish little gantry there, and took a photo of you crossing the finish line with your fist raised in the air, and it just seemed to be the perfect and apropos exclamation point after the performance that you and the entire team had put in. What do you recall of just the feelings of being able to lift off the throttle finally after 10 plus hours of driving and everyone going like maniacs? Was it a sense of relief, elation? What's going through your mind?
I think it was relief, definitely relief, because I could at least phone Dr. Ulrich, who wasn't at the race that particular time, and tell him we had recovered a pretty bad situation. Mm. And I wouldn't get a bill for the accident damage or rollicking from him. But it was basically a relief that we had managed to pull back a bit of embarrassment from the situation. From my point of view, it was a relief that we had won a big fight against Peugeot again. And also, you know, we can't ignore Penske and the Acura guys as well in that. And then seeing Dindo and Manuele as well was just the disbelief that we had been able to get back into a position where we're on the lead lap and on the podium, never mind fighting to win the race or winning the race. And then with Bobby, our number one at the time, you know, just the sheer emotion, and Keith and the guys from Champion and some from Yost and Audi was like, my God, what on earth have we done here? How did we do that? I think was probably the question that we asked ourselves more often than anything else. Clearly, we had a wee bit more of a celebration waiting on the podium and things than certain other people that were there. But from our point of view, it was just amazing, because we had finished first and third as a team. But we had pulled out, I think, probably some of our best performances overall, whether it be in the pits, whether it be in the car, on the engineering stand, the strategy, everything else. We had pulled out some really, really cool moves. When you look back, you just thought, yeah, timing of that was absolutely right. Ron's decision on the stop to go to the soft tire, because I was struggling a little bit with the rear beforehand, just to give the balance of the car a bit of a shift as much as anything else. Or whether it be, you know, the way the guys did with the pit stops, getting us back onto the lead lap, the fixing of the car beforehand. Dominic having the capability as an engineer, which is not always the case, as you know, from engineers, to be able to physically bond brackets on the inside of the footwell of the monocoque lying in there to actually get it done, or Bradsky to be able to get everybody under control to focus on the job in hand. All of it was, I would say, people working at their absolute peak in terms of energy, focus, desire, and also work ethic as well. And so it was a beautiful day in that respect, but it was one that was born out of, unfortunately, the most slowest, stupid incident that I've probably ever had in my career.
Let me ask this to close, mate. And it's one of those horrible questions that journalists ask drivers that maybe you can't answer properly, but You've contested many motor racing events. You have a lot of hardware in your trophy case, etc., etc. Where does Petit Le Mans 2008 rank among at least your mental highlights of best days in a car? Holy cow. I know where it ranks for me when I look at your career as number one. Where does this fall for you in terms of reverie or appreciation?
I'm not a person that looks back very often. I tend to think that's history and, you know, what's next. And that's the way I've sort of lived my life. But there's a few good moments in my career, no question. There's a few that were very pivotal, like my first karting victory or my first Le Mans win was very pivotal. And so therefore, there's different key moments. This wasn't necessarily pivotal for my career, but I think it was, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the highlights as I look back now, for all of the reasons we've just discussed, because of the highs, the lows of what it could have been, but how we actually achieved it, what we achieved on a day under, you know, the competition level we were under. But I suppose the best testament to the race is the fact that that car is my car. I got a hold of that car because it was the car that actually took us to the 2000 Indo and I, to the 06 LMS title, the 07 LMS title. And then only by chance, that because of switchover of monocoques and different things, it was the car that Dindo, Emanuele and I were racing at Petit in 2008, which was its final ever race. And so when we were discussing about different things back at Audi Sport afterwards, I said, I've got to have that car. No questions about it. That car, I have to have it. Because it was a car that I loved to drive so much, but it was also a car, through the different racing programs that I've done with Audi, has probably given me so many different victories. And there's no question that Petit was its crowning glory. And I think it was so appropriate that that was its final race as well, before going off into the into retirement. But what a race it was.
Well, I know you are headed off here shortly. Business trips, flights, all kinds of stuff. Hopefully, this coming Saturday night, you and some of your Audi Sport and Champion Racing brothers can raise a glass wherever you are throughout the globe and just take a moment to celebrate something rather amazing you achieved a decade ago in Braselton, Georgia.
Yeah, well, next Saturday night, I can tell you I'll be raising a glass of Johnny Walker Black for a certain Mr. Dave Mirage, because obviously, you know, there was a lot of the racing programs that we did were centered around about what he allowed us to do and the people that he put together as well. And Petit Le Mans 8 was part of their career as well. And I was pleased that we were able to do that, but I'll be raising it for Champion and for Dave Mirage.
Mate, thanks as always for taking some time to help share fun stories with my listeners, but also you and I catching up, spinning arms.
Cool.
That's one of, one of life's great joys, my man.
Anytime, chap. Anytime. Cranky, I didn't know it was 10 years. I never even considered it until you sent me a note. Never thought about it.
Yeah, well, I count myself as so fortunate as a then relatively new member of the media corps. I mean, this would have been my third year as a journo. And by sheer chance or luck, 2007 was my first full season covering as a reporter, and it happened to be covering the America Le Mans series, and then 2008 as well. So for me, at least, what was truly the ALMS's golden era by chance happened to be where I really got my start. And so that's where I got to see so many. And there was also the latter half of 2006.
Yeah. But
it just on sheer good luck and fortune, I was there to see this and so many other things. So I hold it closely as well.
Just one thing I just remember now as you're speaking. You said about the sort of celebrations afterwards. We went straight across to the press conference, which is in that box on the other side.
Yeah.
And there was a box of Krusty Kreme donuts. And I hoofed this box of Krusty Kreme donuts. You know, there's about four or five of them went in, you know, full Homer Simpson spec. I just remember them sitting there. It was like, I need water. I forget the water. Give me those donuts.
Sugar. I need sugar. Well, look, man. Again, McNish, you give us the perfect opening and closing. You had a Homer Simpson moment to start the event, and then you closed it with a proper Homer Simpson donut moment. So good on you, mate. Good on you.
Yeah. Cool. All right, champ. You take care of yourself. I'm off out for pizza with the kids and Kelly.
And that was our boy Alan McNish. Hope you enjoyed this little walk back to Petit Le Mans, Road Atlanta, 2008, and poor Christian Kleen, poor Peugeot. Obviously, they would learn a thing or two from this, come back in 2009, win Le Mans, do a lot of winning, and granted, as Al suggested, the four rings would move to their R15 model, by no means the most glorious product, but yeah, by the time they got to the R18, the fortunes would certainly begin to return on a big upswing. Still, I hope we get to see Audi back with a top-tier prototype, Peugeot as well, and I just want to see everything back. If we could have 2008 at Petit Le Mans, 2018, and every year, man, maybe get old at some point, but I don't know. Being there, watching it, seeing it happen, the hour by hour, what's the gap now? How are they doing? Are they getting held up? Who got through where? Oh boy, just this back and forth fight. So electric. So thanks to Al for taking some time. Thanks for waking up and then getting Finn off the Wi-Fi. And thanks to Cooper Tire for their support all season long with what we're doing here. Okay, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thanks for listening.